Saturday, Disc 8.
She looks up. Unable to control the muscular spasms in her knees, Rosalind still gazes at her daughter. Everyone else is watching Baxter and waiting. He's hunched over, leaning his weight against the back of the sofa. Though his right hand hasn't moved from Rosalind's neck, his grip on the knife looks slacker, and his posture, the peculiar yielding angle of his spine, suggests a possible ebbing of intent. Could it happen? Is it within the bounds of the real that a mere poem of Daisy's could precipitate a mood swing? At last he raises his head and straightens a little, and then says suddenly, with some petulance, "Read it again." She turns back a page, and with more confidence, attempting the seductive, varied tone of a storyteller entrancing a child, begins again. "The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast the light gleams and is gone." Henry missed the first time the mention of the cliffs of England, glimmering and vast out in the tranquil bay. Now it appears there's no terrace but an open window. There's no young man, father of the child. Instead, he sees Baxter standing alone, elbows propped against the sill, listening to the waves bring the eternal note of sadness in. It's not all of antiquity, but only Sophocles who associated this sound with the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. Even in his state, Henry balks at the mention of a sea of faith and a glittering paradise of wholeness lost in the distant past. Then, once again, it's through Baxter's ears that he hears the sea's melancholy, long-withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges, drear and naked shingles of the world. It rings like a musical curse. The plea to be true to one another sounds hopeless in the absence of joy or love or light or peace or help for pain. Even in a world where ignorant armies clash by night, Henry discovers on second hearing no mention of a desert. The poem's melodiousness, he decides, is at odds with its pessimism. It's hard to tell, for his face is never still, but Baxter appears suddenly elated. His right hand has moved away from Rosalind's shoulder, and the knife is already back in his pocket. His gaze remains on Daisy. The relief she feels, she manages to transform by a feat of self-control and dissembling into a look of neutrality, betrayed only by a trembling in her lower lip as she returns the stare. Her arms hang defencelessly at her sides, the book dangles between her fingers. Grammaticus grips Rosalind's hand. The disgust with which Nigel listened to the poem a second time has only just faded from his face. He says to Baxter, "I'll take the knife while you do the business." Henry worries that a prompt from Nigel, a reminder of the purpose of the visit, could affect another mood swing, a reversion. But Baxter has broken his silence and is saying excitedly,
"You wrote that! You wrote that!"
It's a statement, not a question. Daisy stares at him, waiting. He says again,
"You wrote that!"
And then hurriedly,
"It's beautiful! You know that, don't you? It's beautiful! And you wrote it!"
She dares say nothing.
"It makes me think about where I grew up."
Henry doesn't remember or care where that was. He wants to get to Daisy to protect her. He wants to get to Rosalind, but he's fearful as long as Baxter remains near her. His state of mind is so delicately poised, easily disturbed. It's important not to surprise or threaten him.
"Oi, Baxter!"
Nigel cocks his head at Daisy and smirks.
"Nah, I've changed my mind."
"What? Don't be a cunt."
"Why don't you get dressed?"
Baxter says to Daisy. as though her nakedness was her own strange idea. For a moment she doesn't move, and they wait for her.
"I can't believe it,"
Nigel says.
"We've gone to all this trouble."
She bends to retrieve her sweater and skirt and begins to pull them on. Baxter says eagerly,
"How could you have thought of that? I mean, you just wrote it."
And then he says it again several times over.
"You wrote it!"
She ignores him. Her movements are abrupt as she dresses. There could even be anger in the way she kicks aside the underwear she leaves lying on the floor. She wants to cover herself and get to her mother. Nothing else matters to her. Baxter finds nothing extraordinary in the transformation of his role from Lord of Terror to Amazed Admirer, or Excited Child. Henry is trying to catch his daughter's eye in the hope of silently warning her of the need to go on humouring Baxter. But now she and her mother are embracing. Daisy is kneeling on the floor, half lying across Rosalind's lap with her arms around her neck, and they're whispering and nuzzling, oblivious to Baxter hovering behind them, making frenetic little dips with his body. He's becoming manic. He's tripping over his words and shifting weight rapidly from one foot to the other. Daisy let her book drop on the table when she went to Rosalind. Now Baxter nips forward and seizes it, waves it in the air as if he could shake meaning from it.
"I'm having this,"
he cries.
"You said I could take anything I want, so I'm taking this, okay?"
He's addressing himself to the nape of Daisy's neck.
"Shit,"
Nigel hisses. It's of the essence of a degenerating mind periodically to lose all sense of a continuous self, and therefore any regard for what others think of your lack of continuity. Baxter has forgotten that he forced Daisy to undress or threatened Rosalind. Powerful feelings have obliterated the memory. In the sudden emotional rush of his mood swing, he inhabits the confining bright spotlight of the present. This is the moment to rush him. Henry looks across at Theo, who makes a slow-motion nod of agreement. On the sofa, Grammaticus is sitting up with his hands on his daughter's and granddaughter's shoulders. Rosalind and Daisy remain in their embrace, hard to believe they think they're out of danger, or that by ignoring Baxter they're making themselves more secure. It's the pregnancy, Henry decides, the overwhelming fact of it. It's time to act. Baxter is almost shouting again.
"I'm not taking anything else, you hear? Only this. It's all I want."
He clutches the book like a greedy child, fearing the withdrawal of a treat. Henry glances across at Theo again. He's edged nearer, and he looks tensed, ready to leap. Nigel stands between them watching. But he's disaffected, and there's a chance he'll do nothing. Besides, he, Perrone, is closer to Baxter and will certainly reach him before Nigel can intervene. Again, Perrone feels his pulse knocking in his ears and sees a dozen ways in which it can go wrong. Henry glances once more at Theo and decides to count in his mind to three and then go, no matter what. One. Suddenly Baxter turns. He's licking his lips. His smile is wet and beatific, his eyes are bright. The voice is warm and trembles with exalted feeling.
"I'm going on that trial. I know all about it. They're trying to keep it quiet, but I see all the stuff. I know what's going on."
"Fuck this," Nigel says.
Perrone keeps his tone flat.
"Yes."
"You're going to show me this stuff?"
"Yes, the American trial. It's upstairs in my office."
He had almost forgotten his lie. He looks again at Theo, who now seems to be prompting him with his eyes to go along with this. But he doesn't know that there's no trial. And the price of disappointing Baxter will be high. He's put the book in his pocket and has taken the knife out and waves it in front of Perrone's face.
"Go on, go on! I'll be right behind you."
He's so high now he could stab someone in his joy. He's babbling his words.
The trial, you show me everything, all of it, all of it!
Henry wants to go to Rosalind, touch her hand, speak to her, kiss her. The smallest exchange would be enough, but Baxter is right in front of him now with that peculiar metallic odour on his breath. The original idea was to draw him away from the others and to separate him from Nigel. There's no reason not to carry this through. So, with a final despairing look in Rosalind's direction, Henry turns and walks slowly towards the door.
You watch them,
Baxter says to Nigel.
They're all dangerous.
He follows prone across the hall and they start up the stairs, their steps ringing out in time on the stone. Henry is trying to recall which papers lying around on his desk he can plausibly pass off. He can't remember, and his thoughts are confused by the need to make a plan. There's a paperweight he can throw, and a bulky old stapler. The high-backed orthopaedic office chair will be too heavy to lift. He doesn't even own a paper knife. Baxter is one step behind him, right on his heels. Perhaps a backward kick is the thing.
I know they're keeping it quiet,
Baxter is saying again.
They look after their own, don't they?
They're already halfway up. Even if the trial existed, why would Baxter believe that this doctor would keep his word rather than call in the police? Because he's elated, as well as desperate. Because his emotions are wild and his judgment is going. Because of the wasting in his caudate nucleus and putamen and in his frontal and temporal regions. But none of this is relevant. Perrone needs a plan and his thoughts are too quick, too profuse. And now he and Baxter are on the broad landing outside the study, dominated by the tall window that looks onto the street, just where it runs into the square. Henry hesitates for a moment on the threshold, hoping to see something he might use. The desk lamps have heavy bases, but their tangled wires will restrict him. On a bookshelf is a stone figurine he would have to go on tiptoe to reach. Otherwise, the room is like a museum, a shrine, dedicated to another carefree age. On the couch, covered with a Bokara rug, his squash racket lies where he tossed it when he came up to look at Monday's list. On the big table by the wall, the screensaver, those pictures from the Hubble telescope of remote outer space, gas clouds light years across, dying stars and red giants fail to diminish earthly cares. On the old desk by the window, piles of papers. Perhaps the only hope.
Go on, then.
Baxter pushes him in the small of his back and they enter the room together. It's a dreamy sensation of going quietly, numbly, without protest towards destruction. Henry doesn't doubt that Baxter is feeling free enough to kill him.
Where is it? Show me!
His eagerness and trust is childlike, but he's waving his knife. For their different reasons, they both long for evidence of a medical trial and an invitation for Baxter to join the privileged cohort. Henry goes towards the desk by the window where two piles of journals and off-prints lean side by side. Looking down, he sees an account of a new spinal fusion procedure and a new technique for opening blocked carotid arteries, and a skeptical piece casting doubt on the surgical lesioning of the globus pallidus in the treatment of Parkinson's disease. He chooses the last and holds it up. He has no idea what he's doing beyond delaying the moment. His family is downstairs, and he's feeling very lonely.
This describes the structure,
he starts to say. His voice quavers as a liar's might, but there's nothing he can do but keep talking.
The thing is this. The globus pallidus, the pale globe, is a rather beautiful thing deep in the basal ganglia. One of the oldest parts of the corpus striatum and divided in two segments, which...
But Baxter is no longer paying attention. He's turned his head to listen. From downstairs they hear rapid, heavy footsteps crossing the hall, then the sound of the front door opening and slamming shut. Has he been deserted for the second time today? He hurries across the study and steps out onto the landing. Henry drops the article and follows. What they see is Theo coming towards them at a run, leaping up the stairs three at a time, his arms pumping, his teeth bared savagely with the effort. He makes an inarticulate shout, which sounds like a command. Henry is already moving. Baxter draws back the knife. Henry seizes his wrist with both hands, pinning the arm in place. Contact at last. A moment later, Theo lunges forwards from two steps down and takes Baxter by the lapels of his leather jacket, and with a twisting, whip-like movement of his body, pulls him off balance. At the same time, Perrone, still gripping the arm, heaves with his shoulder, and together they fling him down the stairs. He falls backwards, with arms outstretched, still holding the knife in his right hand. There's a moment which seems to unfold and luxuriously expand, when all goes silent and still. When Baxter is entirely airborne, suspended in time, looking directly at Henry with an expression not so much of terror as dismay. And Henry thinks he sees in the wide brown eyes a sorrowful accusation of betrayal. He, Henry Perrone, possesses so much, the work, money, status, the home, above all, the family. The handsome, healthy son with the strong guitarist's hands come to rescue him. The beautiful poet for a daughter, unattainable even in her nakedness. The famous father-in-law, the gifted, loving wife. And he has done nothing, given nothing to Baxter, who has so little that is not wrecked by his defective gene, and who is soon to have even less. The run of stairs before the turn is long, the steps a hard stone. With a rippling bell-like sound, Baxter's left foot glances along a row of iron banister posts just before his head hits the floor of the half-landing and collides with the wall, inches above the skirting board. They are in various forms of shock and remain so for hours after the police have left and the paramedics have taken Baxter away in their ambulance. Sudden bursts of urgent, sometimes tearful recall are broken by numb silences. No one wants to be alone, so they remain in the sitting room together, trapped in a waiting room, a no-man's land, separating their ordeal from the resumption of their lives. With the resilience of the young, Theo and Daisy go downstairs to the kitchen and return with bottles of red wine, mineral water, and a bowl of salted cashews, as well as ice and a cloth to make a compress for their grandfather's nose. But alcohol, tasty as it is, barely penetrates, and Henry finds that he prefers to drink water. What meets their needs is touch. They sit close, hold hands, embrace. The parting words of the night duty CID officer were that his colleagues would be coming in the morning to take formal statements from them individually. They were therefore not to discuss or compare their evidence. It's a hopeless prescription, and it doesn't even occur to them to follow it. There's nothing to do but talk, fall silent, then talk again. They have the impression of conducting a careful analysis of the evening's horrible events. But it's a simpler, more vital reenactment. All they do is describe. When they came in the room, when he turned, when the tall, horsey one just walked out of the house. They want to have it all again from another's point of view and know that it's all true what they've been through, and feel in these precise comparisons of feeling and observation that they're being delivered from private nightmare and returned to the web of kindly social and familial relations without which they're nothing. They were overrun and dominated by intruders because they weren't able to communicate and act together. Now at last they can. Perrone attends to his father-in-law's nose. John refuses to go to casualty that night and no one tries to persuade him. The swelling already makes a diagnosis difficult, but his nose hasn't shifted from the midline position, and Perrone's guess is a hairline fracture to the maxillary processes. Better that than ruptured cartilage. For much of this stretch of the evening, Henry sits close to Rosalind. She shows them a red patch and a small cut on her neck and describes a moment when she ceased to be terrified and became indifferent to her fate. "I felt myself floating away," she says. "It was as if I was watching all of us, myself included, from a corner of the room right up by the ceiling. And I thought, if it's going to happen, I won't feel a thing, I won't care.
Well, we might have, Theo says.
And they laugh loudly. Too loudly. Daisy talks with brittle gaiety about undressing in front of Baxter.
I tried to pretend that I was 10 years old at school, getting changed for hockey. I disliked the games mistress and hated taking my clothes off when she was there, but remembering her helped me. Then I tried to imagine that I was in the garden at the chateau reciting to Grandad.
The unspoken matter is Daisy's pregnancy. But it's too soon, Henry supposes, because she doesn't refer to it, and nor does Rosalind. Grammaticus says from behind his compress,
"You know, it sounds completely mad, but there came a point after Daisy recited Arnold for the second time when I actually began to feel sorry for that fellow. I think, my dear, you made him fall in love with you."
"Arnold who?" Henry says, and makes Daisy and her grandfather laugh. Henry adds, but she doesn't seem to hear,
"You know, I didn't think it was one of your best."
He knows what Grammaticus means, and he could begin to tell them all about Baxter's condition, but Henry himself is undergoing a shift in sympathies. The sight of the abrasion on Rosalind's neck hardens him. What weakness! What delusional folly to permit yourself sympathy towards a man, sick or not, who invades your house like this. As he sits listening to the others, his anger grows until he almost begins to regret the care he routinely gave Baxter after his fall. He could have left him to die of hypoxia, pleading incapacity through shock. Instead, he went straight down with Theo and, finding Baxter semi-conscious, opened his airway with a jaw thrust. Assuming spinal damage, he showed Theo how to hold Baxter's head while he improvised a collar out of towels from the half-landing bathroom. Downstairs, Rosalind was calling an ambulance. The landlines were not cut. With Theo still holding Baxter's head, Perrone rolled him into a recovery position and looked at the other vital signs. They weren't too good. The breathing was noisy, the pulse slow and weak, the pupils slightly unequal. By this time, Baxter was murmuring to himself as he lay there with eyes closed. He was able to respond to his name and to a command to clench his fist. Perrone put his Glasgow coma score at 13. He went to his study and phoned ahead to casualties, spoke to the registrar and told him what to expect and to be ready to order a CT scan and alert the neurosurgeon on duty. Then there was nothing to do but wait out the last minutes. During that time, they managed to ease Daisy's book from Baxter's pocket. Theo continued to support his head until two lads from the hospital in green jumpsuits arrived, put in a line and, under Perrone's instruction, administered colloid fluid intravenously. Two police constables arrived in support of the ambulance, and a few minutes later the CID man turned up. After he'd met the family and heard Perrone's account, he told them it was too late, and everyone was too upset now to be giving statements. He took from Henry the license plate number of the red BMW and made a note of the spearmint rhino. He examined the gash in the sofa. Then he went back upstairs, knelt by Baxter, prized the knife out of his hand, and dropped it in a sterile plastic bag. He took a swab of dried blood from the knuckles of Baxter's left hand. It was likely to be blood from Grammaticus's nose. The detective laughed out loud when Theo asked him whether he and his father had committed any crime in throwing Baxter down the stairs. He touched Baxter with the tip of his shoe.
"I doubt if he'll be making a complaint, and we certainly won't be."
The detective phoned his station to arrange for two constables to be sent to the hospital to stand guard over Baxter through the night. When he was conscious, he'd be arrested. Formal charges would follow later. After the warning about sharing evidence, the three policemen left. The paramedics chocked and blocked Baxter on a spinal board and carried him away. Rosalind appears to make an impressive recovery. Perhaps it's only half an hour after the police and ambulance men have left when she suggests that it might do everybody good to come and eat. No one has an appetite, but they follow her down to the kitchen. While Perrone reheats his stock and takes from the fridge the clams, mussels, prawns and monkfish, the children lay the table, Rosalind slices a loaf of bread and makes a dressing for the salad, and Grammaticus puts down his ice pack to open another bottle of wine. This communal activity is pleasurable, and 20 minutes later the meal is ready and they are hungry at last. It's even faintly reassuring that Grammaticus is on his way to getting drunk, though he remains at a benign stage. It's about this time, as they're sitting down, that Henry learns the name of the poet Matthew Arnold, and that his poem that Daisy recited, Dover Beach, is in all the anthologies, and used to be taught in every school. "Like your Mount Fuji," Henry says, a remark that pleases Grammaticus immensely and prompts him to stand to propose a toast. John's in his twinkly mode, an effect heightened by his clownishly swollen nose. The evening has the appearance of being back on course, for in his hand is the proof copy of My Saucy Bark.
"Forget everything else that's happened. We're raising our glasses to Daisy," he says. "Her poems mark a brilliant beginning to a career, and I'm a very proud grandfather and dedicatee. Who would have thought that learning poems by heart for pocket money would turn out to be so useful? After tonight, I think I must owe her another £5. To Daisy."
"To Daisy," they reply. And as they lift their glasses, she kisses him, and he hugs her in return. The reconciliation is made. The Newdigate rebuff is forgotten. Henry touches the wine to his lips but finds he's lost his taste for alcohol. Just as Daisy and her grandfather sit down, the phone rings, and since he's nearest, Henry goes across the kitchen to take the call. In his unusual state, he doesn't immediately recognize the American voice.
"Henry? Is that you, Henry?"
"Oh, Jay, yes.
Listen, we got an extra dural, male, mid-20s, fell down the stairs. Sally Madden went home with the flu an hour ago, so I've got Rodney. The kid's keen and he's good and he doesn't want you in here, but Henry, we have a depressed fracture right over the sinus."
Perrone clears his throat.
"Boggy swelling?"
"Right on the spot.
That's why I'm stepping in. I've seen inexperienced surgeons tear the sinus lifting the bone and 4 liters of blood on the floor. I want someone senior in here, and you're the nearest. Plus, you're the best."
From across the kitchen comes loud, unnatural laughter, exaggerated like before, almost harsh. They're not really pretending to have forgotten their fear. They're simply wanting to survive it. There are other surgeons Jay can call on, and as a general rule, Perrone avoids operating on people he knows. But this is different. And despite various shifts in his attitude to Baxter, some clarity, even some resolve, is beginning to form. He thinks he knows what it is he wants to do.
"Henry, you there?"
"I'm on my way."
Chapter 5. The family is used to Perrone's occasional departures from dinner, and in this case there may even be some reassurance, a suggestion of a world returning to the everyday in his announcement that he's been called to the hospital. He leans by Daisy's chair and says into her ear, "We've a lot to talk about." Without turning, she takes his hand and squeezes. He's about to say to Theo, perhaps for the third time that evening, "You saved my life," but instead he half smiles at his son and mouths, "See you later." Theo has never seemed so handsome, so beautiful as now. His bare, lean arms lie across the table. The solemn, clear brown eyes and their curling lashes, the blind perfection of hair, skin, teeth, the unbent, untroubled spine. He gleams in the half-light of the kitchen. He raises his glass, mineral water, and says,
"You sure you're up to this, Dad?"
Grammaticus says,
"He's right, you know.
It's been a long night. You could kill some poor bugger.
With his swept-back silver hair and nose compress, he resembles a patched-up lion in a children's book.
I'm fine.
There's been talk of Theo fetching down an acoustic guitar to accompany his grandfather in St. James's Infirmary, for Grammaticus is in the mood for a Doc Watson imitation. Rosalind and Daisy want to hear the recording of Theo's new song, City Square. There's an air of unnatural festivity around the table, of wild release, which reminds Henry of a family outing to the theatre the previous year, an evening of bloody and startling atrocities at the royal court. At dinner afterwards, they pass the evening in hilarious reminiscence of summer holidays and drinking too much. When he said his farewells and is leaving, Grammaticus calls after him,
"We'll still be here when you get back."
Perrone knows this is unlikely, but he nods cheerfully. Only Rosalind senses the deeper alteration in his mood. She rises and follows him up the stairs and watches him as he puts on his overcoat and finds his wallet and keys. "Henry, why did you say yes?"
"It's him."
"So why did you agree?" They are standing by the front door with its triple locks and the keypad's comforting glow. He kisses her. Then she draws him towards her by his lapels, and they kiss again, longer and deeper. It's a reminder, a resumption of their morning lovemaking, and also a promise. This is surely how they must end such a day. She tastes salty, which arouses him. Far below his desire, lying like a granite block on the sea floor, is his exhaustion. But at times like this, on his way to the theatre, he's professionally adept at resisting all needs. As they pull away, he says, "I had a scrape in the car with him this morning."
"I gathered that."
"And a stupid showdown on the pavement."
"So, why are you going in?"
She licks her forefinger, he likes this glimpse of her tongue, and straightens his eyebrows for him. Thickening with unruly tendrils of ginger, grey, and unblemished white tending to the vertical, evidence of the clotted testosterone that can also cause ear and nostril hair to grow like winter sedge. More evidence of decline. He says, "I have to see this through. I'm responsible." In reply to her querying look, he adds, "He's very sick. Probably Huntington's."
"He's obviously nuts as well as nasty. But Henry, weren't you drinking earlier? Can you really operate?"
"It was a while ago. I think the adrenaline's rather cleared my head." She's fingering the lapel of his coat, keeping him close. She doesn't want him to leave. He watches her tenderly, and with some amazement, for her ordeal is only 2 or 3 hours behind her, and now here she is, pretending to be entirely herself again, and, as always, keen to know the components of an unusual decision, and loving him in her precise, exacting way, a lawyer to the core. He forces his gaze from settling on the abrasion on her throat.
"Are you going to be all right?"
She's lowered her eyes as she orders her thoughts. When she lifts them, he sees himself, by some trick of light, suspended in miniature against the black arena of her pupils, embraced by a tiny field of mid-green iris. She says,
"I think so. Look, I'm worried about you going in."
"Meaning?"
"You're not thinking about doing something, about some kind of revenge, are you?"
"I want you to tell me."
"Of course not."
He pulls her towards him and they kiss again, and this time their tongues touch and slide by each other, in their private lexicon a kind of promise. Revenge. He suddenly doubts he's ever heard the word on her lips before. In Rosalind's slightly breathless utterance it sounds erotic, the very word. And what is he doing? Leaving the house. Even as he frames the question, he knows he's going. Superficially, it's simple momentum. Jay Strauss and the team will already be in the anaesthetist's room starting work on his patient. Henry has an image of his own right hand pushing open the swing doors to the scrub room. In a sense, he's already left, though he's still kissing Rosalind. He ought to hurry. He murmurs, "If I'd handled things better this morning, perhaps none of this would have happened. Now Jay's asked me in, I feel I ought to go. And I want to go." She looks at him wryly, still trying to gauge his intentions, his precise state of mind, the strength of the bond between them at this particular moment. Because he's genuinely curious to know the story, but also to deflect her, he then says, "So we're going to be grandparents." There's sadness in her smile. She's 13 weeks, and she says she's in love. Giulio is 22, from Rome, studying archaeology in Paris. His parents have given them enough money to buy a little flat. Henry contends with fatherly thoughts, with nascent outrage at this unknown Italian's assault on the family's peace and cohesion, at his impertinently depositing his seed without first making himself available for inspection, evaluation. Where was he now, for example? And irritation that this boy's own family should know before Daisy's, that arrangements are already in hand. A little flat. 13 weeks. Perrone leans his hand on the door lock's ancient brassy knob. At last, Daisy's pregnancy, the evening's buried subject, rises before him in clear light. A calamity and an insult and a waste. A subject too huge to confront or lament now, when he is waited for up the road. Oh, God. What a mess. Why didn't she tell us? Did she think about a termination? Out of the question, apparently. Darling, don't start boiling over when you're about to operate. How are they going to live? The way we did. In a bliss of sex and graduate poverty, taking turns with baby Daisy as together they sleeplessly raced through a law degree and first law job and the early years of neurosurgery. He remembers himself after a 30-hour shift carrying his bicycle 4 floors up a cement stairwell towards the insomniac wail of a teething infant. And in that one-bedroom flat in Archway, folding the ironing board away in order to fuck late at night on the living room floor by the gas fire. Rosalind may have intended such recollections to mollify him. He appreciates the attempt, but he's troubled. What's to become of Daisy Perrone, the poet? He and Rosalind meshed their timetables and worked hard at sharing the domestic load. Italian men, on the other hand, are pueri aeterni, who expect their wives to replace their mothers and iron their shirts and fret about their underwear. This feckless Giulio could destroy his daughter's hopes. Henry discovers he's clenching a fist. He relaxes it and says untruthfully, "I can't think about it now." "That's right. None of us can." "I'd better go." They kiss again, unerotically this time, with all the restraint of a farewell. As he opens the door, she says, "I'm still worried about you going in like this. I mean, in this mood. Promise me. Nothing foolish." He touches her arm. "I promise." As the door closes behind him and he steps away from the house, he feels a clarifying pleasure in the cold, wet night air, in his purposeful stride, and, he can admit it, in being briefly alone. If only the hospital were further away. Irresponsibly, he prolongs his walk by half a minute by going across the square rather than down Warren Street. The few fine snowflakes he saw earlier have vanished, and during the evening it has rained. The square's paving stones and cobbled gutters shine cleanly in the white streetlight. Low smoky cloud grazes the top of the post office tower. The square is deserted, which also pleases him. As he hurries along the eastern side near the high railings of the gardens, under the bare plane trees stirring and creaking, the empty square is reduced to its vastness and the simplicity of architectural lines and solemn white forms. He's trying not to think about Giulio. He thinks instead about Rome, where he attended a neurosurgery symposium 2 years ago in rooms overlooking the Campo dei Fiori. It was the mayor himself, Walter Veltroni, a quiet, civilized man with a passion for jazz, who opened the proceedings. The following day, in honor of the guests, Nero's palace, the Domus Aurea, much of it still closed to the public, was made available, and Veltroni, along with various curators, gave the surgeons a private tour. Perrone, knowing nothing about Roman antiquity, was disappointed that the site appeared to be underground, entered by a gated hole in a hillside. This was not what he understood by a palace. They were led down a tunnel smelling of earth and lit by bare bulbs. Off to the sides were dim chambers where restoration work was in progress on fragments of wall tiles. A curator explained, 300 rooms of white marble, frescoes, intricately patterned mosaic, pools, fountains and ivory finish, but no kitchens, bathrooms or lavatories. At last, the surgeons entered a scene of wonders. Painted corridors of birds and flowers and complicated repeating designs. They saw rooms where frescoes were just appearing from under a sludge of grime and fungus. The palace lay undiscovered for 500 years under rubble until the early Renaissance. For the past 20 years, it had been closed for restoration, and its partial opening had been part of Rome's millennial celebration. A curator pointed out a jagged hole far above them in an immense domed ceiling. This was where 15th-century robbers dug through to steal gold leaf. Later, Raphael and Michelangelo had themselves lowered down on ropes. Marvelling, they copied the designs and paintings their smoking torches revealed. Their own work was profoundly influenced by these incursions. Through his translator, Signor Veltroni offered an image he thought might appeal to his guests. The artists had drilled through this skull of brick to discover the mind of ancient Rome. Perrone leaves the square and heads east, crosses the Tottenham Court Road and walks towards Gower Street. If only the mayor was right, that penetrating the skull brings into view not the brain but the mind. Then, within the hour, he, Perrone, might understand a lot more about Baxter, and after a lifetime's routine procedures would be among the wisest men on earth. Wise enough to understand Daisy? He's not able to avoid the subject. Henry refuses to accept that she might have chosen to be pregnant. But for her sake, he needs to be positive and generous. This Roman Giulio may be just like the admirable boiler-suited types he saw in the gloomy chambers of the Domus Aurea, dabbing away at mosaic tiles with their toothbrushes. Archaeology is an honourable profession. It's his duty, Henry supposes, to try to like the father of his grandchild, the despoiler of his daughter. When he condescends at last to visit, young Giulio will need to exert much native charm. On Gower Street, the sanitary teams are still at work, cleaning up after the demonstration. Perhaps they've only just begun. From noisy trucks, generator-powered arc lights illuminate mounds of food, plastic wrappings and discarded placards which men in yellow and orange jackets are pushing forward with wide brooms. Others are shoveling the piles onto the lorries. The state's embrace is ample, ready for war, ready to clean up behind the dissenters. And the debris has a certain archaeological interest. A not-in-my-name with a broken stalk lies among polystyrene cups and abandoned hamburgers and pristine flyers for the British Association of Muslims. On a pile he steps round are a slab of pizza with pineapple slices, beer cans in a tartan motif, a denim jacket, empty milk cartons and three unopened tins of sweet corn. The details are oppressive to him. Objects look too bright-edged and tight, ready to burst from the packaging. He must be in a lingering state of shock. He recognizes one of the sweepers as the man he saw this morning cleaning the pavements in Warren Street. A whole day behind the broom, and now, courtesy of untidy world events, some serious overtime. Around the hospital's front entrance, there's the usual late-night Saturday gathering, and two security guards standing between the double sets of doors. Typically, people emerge, though not completely, from a drunken dream and remember they last saw a friend being lifted into the back of an ambulance. They find the hospital, often the wrong one, and emphatically demand to see this friend. The guard's job is to keep out the troublemakers, the abusive or incapable, the ones likely to throw up on the waiting room floor, or take a swing at authority, at a light-boned Filipino nurse or some tired junior doctor in the final hours of her shift. They're also obliged to keep out the rough sleepers who want a bench or piece of floor in the institutional warmth. The sample of the public that makes it to a hospital late on a weekend night is not always polite, kind, or appreciative. As Henry recalls, working in accident and emergency is a lesson in misanthropy. They used to be tolerated, the assaults, as well as the dossers, who even had their own little corner in A&E. But these last few years, what's now called the culture has changed. The medical staff have had enough. They want protection. The drunks and loudmouths are thrown out onto the pavement by men who've worked as bouncers and know their business. It's another American import, and not a bad one. Zero tolerance. But there's always a danger of chucking out a genuine patient. Head injuries, as well as cases of sepsis or hypoglycemia, can present as drunkenness. Perrone pushes away through the small knot of people. When he reaches the first door, the guards, Mitch and Tony, both West Indian, recognize him and let him through.
How's it going?
Tony, whose wife died of breast cancer last year and who's thinking of training as a paramedic, says,
Quiet, you know, relative-like.
Yeah, Mitch says. We just got the quiet riot tonight.
Both men chuckle, and Mitch adds,
Now, Mr. Perrone, all the wise surgeons got the flu.
I'm truly unwise, Henry says. There's an extradural. We seen him.
Yeah, you better get up there, Mr. Perrone.
But instead of going straight ahead to the main lifts, he makes a quick detour through the waiting area towards the treatment rooms, just in case Jay or Rodney, while waiting, have come down for another case. The public benches are quiet, but the long room has a battered, exhausted look, as though at the end of a successful party. The air is humid and sweet. There are drinks cans on the floor and someone's sock among the chocolate bar wrappers from the vending machines. A girl has an arm round her boyfriend who's slumped forward, head between his knees. An old lady wearing a fixed, faint smile waits patiently with her crutches resting on her lap. There are one or two others staring at the floor and someone stretched out full length, asleep on a bench, head covered by a coat. Perrone walks past the treatment cubicles to the crash room where a team is working on a man who's bleeding heavily from his neck. Outside, in the major's area, by the staff base, he sees Fares, the on-duty A&E registrar whom he spoke to on the phone. As Perrone approaches, Fares says,
Oh, right, that friend you phoned about. We've cleared cervical spine. The CT scan showed a bilateral extradural with a probable depressed fracture. He dropped a couple of points, so we called in a crash induction. They took him upstairs half an hour ago.
An X-ray of the neck, the first investigative measure, suggests there'll be no complications with Baxter's breathing. His level of consciousness, as measured by the Glasgow coma score, has fallen. Not a good sign. An anaesthetist, probably Jay's registrar, was called down to prepare him for emergency surgery, which will have involved, among other things, emptying Baxter's stomach.
What's his score now?
11 down from 13 when he came in.
Someone calls Fares's name from the crash room, and by way of excusing himself, he says as he leaves,
Bottle fight in a bus queue. And, oh, yeah, Mr. Perrone. Two policemen went up with your friend.
Perrone takes the lift up to the third floor. As soon as he steps out into the broad area that gives onto the double doors of the neurosurgical suite, he feels better. Home from home. Though things sometimes go wrong, he can control outcomes here. He has resources, controlled conditions. The doors are locked. Peering through the glass, he can see no one about. Rather than ring the bell, he takes a long route down a corridor that will bring him through intensive care. He likes it here late at night. The muted light, the expansive, vigilant silence, the solemn calm of the few night staff. He goes down the wide space between the beds, among winking lights and the steady bleeps of the monitors. None of these patients is his. Now that Andrea Chapman has been moved out, all the people on yesterday's list are back in their wards. That's satisfying. In the marshalling area outside the ICU, the space looks unnaturally empty. The usual clutter of trolleys has been removed. Tomorrow, they'll be back. And all the bustle, the constantly ringing phones, the minor irritation with the porters. Rather than call Rodney or Jay out of the theatre, and to save time, he goes straight to the changing room. He taps a code in the number lock and steps into a cramped and homely squalor, a particularly masculine kind of pigsty suggestive of several dozen delinquent boys far from home. He uses a key to open his locker and starts to undress hurriedly. Lily Perrone would have been horrified. Scattered across the floor are discarded scrubs, some clean, some used, along with the plastic bags they came in, and trainers, a towel, an old sweater, a pair of jeans. On the tops of the lockers, empty Coke cans, an ancient tennis racket press, two unrelated sections of a fly fishing rod that had been lying there for months. On the wall, a peevish computer-printed notice asks, "Is it possible to discard towels and greens in the appropriate manner?" Some wag has written "no" underneath. Another more official sign advises, "Don't take risks with your valuables." There used to be a sign on the lavatory door saying, "Please raise the seat." Now there's one saying, in resignation, "To complain about the state of the lavatory, dial extension 4040. A prospective surgical patient would not feel reassured by the racks of white cloth stained with yellow, red, and brown. Beginning to be in a hurry and not find a matching pair. Henry keeps his own in his locker. He takes his scrubs, tops and bottoms, from the large pile and puts them on, and makes a point of binning the plastic bag. Despite the chaos around him, these actions calm him, like mental exercises before a chess game. At the door, he takes a disposable surgical cap from a pile and secures it behind his head as he goes along the empty corridor. He enters the theatre by way of the anaesthetic room. Waiting for him, sitting by their machine, are Jay Strauss and his registrar, Geeta Sial. Round the table are Emily, the scrub nurse, Joan, the runner, and Rodney, looking like a man about to be tortured. Perrone knows from experience how wretched a registrar feels when his consultant has to come out, even when it's an obvious necessity. In this case, it hasn't even been Rodney's decision. Jay Strauss has pulled rank. Rodney's bound to feel that Jay has grassed him up. On the table, obscured by surgical drapes, is Baxter lying face down. All that's visible of him is the wide area of his head shaved to the rear of the vertex, the crown. Once a patient is draped up, the sense of a personality, an individual in the theatre, disappears. Such is the power of the visual sense. All that remains is the little patch of head, the field of operation. There's an air in the room of boredom, of small talk exhausted. Or perhaps Jay has been holding forth on the necessity of the coming war. Rodney will have been reluctant to voice his pacifist views for fear of being taken apart. Jay says, 25 minutes. That's pretty good, Chief. Henry raises a hand in greeting, then gestures at the young registrar to accompany him to the light box where Baxter's scans are on display. On one sheet, 16 images. 16 bacon slices through Baxter's brain. The clot, trapped between the skull and its tough, membranous inner lining, the dura, sits across the midline, the division between the two hemispheres of the brain. It's 2 inches or so below the vertex and is large, almost perfectly round, and shows pure white on the scan, with telltale precise margins. The fracture is clearly visible too, 7 inches long, running at right angles to the midline. In its centre, sitting right on that midline, is shattered bone, where the skull has partially caved in. Right below that depressed fracture, vulnerable to the sharp edges of displaced bone, tilted like tectonic plates, runs a major blood vessel, the superior sagittal sinus. It extends along the fold, the falx, where the two hemispheres meet, and it's the major vein draining blood away from the brain. It sits snugly in the groove formed where the dura wraps separately round each hemisphere. Several hundred millilitres per minute flow through the sinus, and it's possible for a surgeon to tear it while lifting the broken bone. So much blood escapes you can't see to make a repair. This is when a year two registrar can panic, and this is why J. Strauss has called Henry. While he's looking at the scans, Perrone says to Rodney, "Tell me about the patient." Rodney clears his throat. His tongue sounds thick and heavy. "Male, in his 20s, fell downstairs about 3 hours ago. He was drowsy in casualty with a Glasgow coma score of 13 dropping to 11. Skull lacerations, no other injury recorded. Normal C-spine X-ray. They did a scan, ordered a crash induction and sent him straight up." Perrone glances over his shoulder at the monitors on the anaesthetic machine. Baxter's pulse shows 85 and blood pressure 130 over 94. "And the scan?" Rodney hesitates, perhaps wondering if there's a catch, something he didn't notice that could compound his humiliation. He's a big lad, occasionally and touchingly homesick for Guyana, where he has ambitions to set up a head injury unit one day. He once had hopes of playing rugby for a serious team, until medicine and neurosurgery took him over. He has a friendly, intelligent face, and the word is that women adore him, and he puts himself about. Perrone suspects he'll turn out well. "It's a midline depressed fracture, both extradural and..." Rodney points to an image higher up the sheet and a small white mass shaped like a comma, "subdural too." He's seen the only slightly unusual feature, a clot below the dura as well as the larger one above it. "Good," Perrone murmurs. And with that one word, Rodney's evening is rescued. There is, however, a third abnormality the registrar will not have noticed. As medicine progresses, certain diagnostic tricks fall into disuse among the younger doctors. In a frame further up the sheet, Baxter's chordate on both sides of the brain lacks the usual convexity, the normal healthy bulge into the anterior horn of the lateral ventricles. Before DNA testing, this shrinking was a useful confirmation of Huntington's disease. Henry never doubted he was right, but the physical evidence confers its own bleak satisfaction. Henry says to Jay, "Is there blood around?" Gita Seal answers, "Plenty in the fridge." "Is the patient hemodynamically stable?" "Blood pressure and pulse are okay, and pre-op bloods are fine. Airway pressure's fine," Jay says. "We're ready to roll, boss." Perrone takes a look at Baxter's head to make sure Rodney has shaved him in exactly the right place. The laceration is straight and clean. A wall, a skirting board, a stone floor landing rather than the grit and filth you see in wounds after a road traffic accident, and has been sewn up by A&E. Even without touching, he can see that the top of his patient's head has an area of boggy swelling. Blood is collecting between the bone and the scalp. Satisfied with the registrar's work, he says to him as he leaves, "Take the sutures out while I scrub up." Henry pauses in the corner to choose some piano music. He decides on the Goldberg variations.
He has four recordings here, and selects not the showy unorthodoxies of Glenn Gould, but Angela Hewitt's wise and silky playing, which includes all the repeats. Less than 5 minutes later, in long disposable gown, gloves and mask, he's back at the table. He nods at Geeta to start the CD player. From the stainless steel trolley Emily has positioned at his side, he takes a sponge on a clamp and dips it in a bowl of betadine solution. The tender, wistful aria begins to unfold and spread, hesitantly it seems at first, and makes the theatre seem even more spacious. At the very first stroke of sunflower yellow on pale skin, a familiar contentedness settles on Henry. It's the pleasure of knowing precisely what he's doing, of seeing the instruments arrayed on the trolley, of being with his firm in the muffled quiet of the theatre. The murmur of the air filtration, the sharper hiss of oxygen passing into the mask taped to Baxter's face out of sight under the drapes, the clarity of the overhead lights. It's a reminder from childhood of the closed fascination of a board game. He sets down the brush and says quietly, "Local." Emily passes him the hypodermic she has prepared. Quickly, he injects in several places under skin, along the line of the laceration and beyond. It's not strictly necessary, but the adrenaline in the lignocaine helps reduce the bleeding. At each location, the scalp immediately swells into bumps. He sets down the hypodermic and opens his hand. He doesn't have to ask. Emily places within his grasp the nicely weighted skin knife. With it, he extends the laceration by several inches and deepens it. Rodney is close at his side with the bipolar cauterizer, closing off the bleeding points in two or three places. At each contact, there is a bleep, and a thin trail of greyish smoke rises with the sharp odour of singed flesh. Despite his bulk, Rodney cleverly avoids crowding his consultant's space and applies the small blue rainy clips that pinch tightly on the parted skin and close off the blood supply. Perrone asks for the first of the big self-retaining retractors and sets it in place. He lets Rodney attach the second, and now the long incision is stretched apart like a wide-open mouth to reveal the skull and all the damage. The fracture runs fairly straight. Blood, altered blood, is rising up through it. Once Rodney has washed out the area with saline and wiped it, they can see the crack in the bone is about 2 millimeters wide. It looks like an earthquake fissure seen from the air, or a crack in a dry riverbed. The depressed fracture in the centre has two segments of bone at a tilt with three other finer cracks radiating from them. There'll be no need to drill a burr hole. Perrone will be able to slip the cutting saw into the larger fissure. Emily presents the craniotome, but he doesn't like the look of the footpiece. It seems a little skewed. Joan hurries into the prep room and comes back with another. It's satisfactory, and while she unpacks it from the sterile wrapping and fits it, he says to Rodney, "We'll turn a free flap around the depressed fracture so that we've got full control of the sinus." It is said that no one opens up faster than Henry Perrone. Now he goes even more quickly than usual because there's no danger of damaging the dura. The clot is pressing down on it, pushing it away from the skull. Although Rodney leans in with a Dakin's syringe to douse the cutting edge with saline solution, the smell of singed bone fills the theatre. It's a smell Henry sometimes finds clinging to the folds of his clothes when he undresses at the end of a long day. It's impossible to speak over the high-pitched whine of the craniotome. With his eyes, he indicates to Rodney that he should observe closely. Exceptional care is needed now as he guides the saw across the midline. He slows and tilts the footpiece of the drill upwards. Otherwise, there's a danger that it will catch and tear the sinus. It's a wonder brains come to any harm at all outside an operating theatre when they're encased so thickly in bone. At last, Perrone has cut round a complete oval shape behind the crown of Baxter's head. Before he lifts the flap, he examines the fragments of the depressed fracture. He asks for a Watson-Cheney dissector and levers them gently up. They come away easily, and he puts them into the kidney bowl of betadine that Emily offers. Now, using the same dissector,
He lifts the whole free flap away from the skull, a large piece of bone like a segment of coconut, and lays it in the bowl with the other bits. The clot is in full view, red of such darkness it is almost black, and of the consistency of recently set jam. Or, as Perrone sometimes thinks, like a placenta. But round the edges of the clot, blood is flowing freely now that the pressure of the bone flap has been relieved. It pours from the back of Baxter's head, over the surgical drapes, and onto the floor. "Elevate the head of the table. Give me as much as you can," Henry calls to Jay. If the bleed is higher than the heart, the blood will flow less copiously. The table rises, and Henry and Rodney step back in quickly through the blood at their feet and, working together, use a sucker and an Adson elevator to remove the clot. They irrigate the area with saline, and at last we get a glimpse of the tear, about a quarter of an inch long, in the sinus. The bone flap was well placed. The damage is right in the centre of the exposure. The welling blood immediately obscures their view again. An edge of bone from the depressed fragment must have pierced the vessel. While Rodney holds the sucker in place, Perrone takes a strip of surgicel and lays it over the tear, places a swab on top and indicates to Rodney to press down with his finger. Henry asks Jay, "How much blood have we lost?" He hears Jay ask Joan how much irrigation has been used. Together, they make the calculation. 2.5 liters, the anaesthetist says quietly. Perrone is about to ask for the periostal elevator, but Emily is already placing it in his hands. He finds an area of exposed but undamaged skull, and with the elevator, a kind of scraper, harvests two long pieces of pericranium, the fibrous membrane that covers the bone. Rodney lifts the swab, and is about to lift also the surgicel from the tear, but Perrone shakes his head. A clot might be already forming, and he doesn't want to disturb it. He gently lays the strip of pericranium over the surgicel and adds a second layer of surgicel and the second strip of pericranium and places a new swab on top, then Rodney's finger. Perrone rinses out the area again with saline and waits. The opaque, milky bluish dura remains clear. The bleeding has stopped. But they can't begin to close up yet. Perrone takes a scalpel and makes a small incision in the dura, parts it a little, and peers inside. The surface of Baxter's brain is indeed covered with a clot, much smaller than the first. He extends the incision and Rodney tucks back the dura with stay sutures. Perrone is pleased with the speed of his junior registrar's work. Rodney uses the Adson to lift out the congealed blood. They wash out with saline, sucker the mix away, and wait to see if the bleeding continues. Perrone suspects that one of the nearby arachnoid granulations could be a source. There's nothing, but he doesn't close up just yet. He prefers to wait a few minutes, just to be sure. In this lull, Rodney goes over to a table by the prep room door and sits down to drink a bottle of water. Emily is busy with the instrument tray. Joan is dealing with the wide pool of blood on the floor. Jay breaks off a murmured conversation with his registrar to say to Perrone, "We're fine over here." Henry remains at the head of the table. Though he's been conscious of the music, only now does he give it his full attention again. Well over an hour has passed, and Hewitt is already at the final variation. The quadlibet, uproarious and jokey, raunchy even, with its echoes of peasant songs of food and sex. The last exultant chords fade away, a few seconds silence, then the aria returns, identical on the page but changed by all the variations that have come before, still tender, but resigned too, and sadder, the piano notes floating in from a distance as though from another world, and only slowly swelling. He's looking down at a portion of Baxter's brain. He can easily convince himself that it's familiar territory, a kind of homeland with its low hills and enfolded valleys of the sulci, each with a name and imputed function, as known to him as his own house. Just to the left of the midline, running laterally away out of sight under the bone, is the motor strip. Behind it, running parallel, is the sensory strip. So easy to damage, with such terrible, lifelong consequences. How much time he has spent making routes to avoid these areas, like bad neighbourhoods in an American city. And this familiarity numbs him daily to the extent of his ignorance, and of the general ignorance. For all the recent advances, it's still not known how this well-protected 1 kilogram or so of cells actually encodes information, how it holds experiences, memories, dreams, and intentions. He doesn't doubt that in years to come, the coding mechanism will be known, though it might not be in his lifetime. Just like the digital codes of replicating life held within DNA, the brain's fundamental secret will be laid open one day. But even when it has, the wonder will remain that mere wet stuff can make this bright inward cinema of thought, of sight and sound and touch, bound into a vivid illusion of an instantaneous present, with a self, another brightly wrought illusion hovering like a ghost at its centre. Could it ever be explained? How matter becomes conscious? He can't begin to imagine a satisfactory account, but he knows it will come. The secret will be revealed. Over decades, as long as the scientists and the institutions remain in place, the explanations will refine themselves into an irrefutable truth about consciousness. It's already happening. The work is being done in laboratories not far from this theatre. And the journey will be completed, Henry's certain of it. That's the only kind of faith he has. There's grandeur in this view of life. No one else in the theatre knows the hopeless condition of this particular brain. The motor strip he's looking at now is already compromised by disease, most likely by deterioration in the caudate and putamen deep in the centre of the brain. Henry places his finger on the surface of Baxter's cortex. He sometimes touches a brain at the beginning of a tumour operation, testing the consistency. What a wonderful fairy tale. How understandable and human it was, the dream of the healing touch. If it could simply be achieved with the caress of a forefinger, he'd do it now. But the limits of the art, of neurosurgery as it stands today, are plain enough. Faced with these unknown codes, this dense and brilliant circuitry, he and his colleagues offer only brilliant plumbing. Baxter's unmendable brain, exposed under the bright theatre lights, has remained stainless for several minutes. There's no sign of any bleeding from the arachnoid granulation. Prone nods at Rodney. It's looking fine. You can close up. Because he's pleased with him and wants him to feel better about the evening, Perrone lets his registrar take the lead. Rodney sews up the dura with purple thread 3-0 Vicryl and inserts the extradural drain. He replaces the bone flap along with the 2 broken pieces from the depressed fracture. Then he drills the skull to screw in place the titanium plates that hold the bone secure. This part of Baxter's skull now resembles crazy paving or a broken china doll's head clumsily repaired. Rodney inserts the subgallial drain and then sets about sewing the skin of the scalp with 2-0 Vicryl and punching in the skin staples. Perrone gets Gita to put on Barber's Adagio for strings. It's been played to death on the radio these past years, but Henry sometimes likes it in the final stages of an operation. This languorous, meditative music suggests a long labour coming to an end at last.
This ends Disc 8.